Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say.
Hey everybody, welcome. This is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Frontlines. In a particularly exciting period in my own life, and I hope in your life, because over the next 4 or 6 or 8 weeks, we're going to stay on the theme of Mississippi Freedom Summer, because it's my view that that encapsulated period that, of course, didn't start in 1964, nothing ever did. It started in 63, which was prefaced by 62. But between May, June of 1964 and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenge in August of 1964, I believe, set so many of the terms of the entire civil rights revolution, which I begin in some ways believe was most made explicitly after MFDP was turned back in Atlantic City, and was crushed during the periods of the 70s by what I would consider a very conscious counter-revolution. So here we are today in Mississippi for the 50th anniversary. You're listening to a pre-recorded show that we're doing with Judy Richardson and with Claiborne Carson, two very important figures, both in the civil rights movement and also very much in terms of the role of history and trying to reconstruct the historical record. Judy and Clay, very nice to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks, Eric, and hello, Clay.
Hi. It's been a while. I look forward to seeing you soon, Judy.
Yes.
So one of the things I just wanted to start with, if you bear with my own little history for a minute, and this is going to frame the conversation with Judy and Clay. Mississippi summer, like every other aspect of the Black Freedom Movement, has been sanitized and trivialized by the system, covering up the revolutionary challenge of the struggle for democratic rights for Black people inside the United States and the Black Belt South in particular. V.R. Lenin said that there are centuries in which years happen and years in which centuries happen. During the 1960s, each year was a century, and the actual spiritual, political, tactical, strategic development of the young organizers are moving at the speed of light. As Peniel Joseph observed in his book Stokely a Life, Carmichael now embarked on a quest for Black political power. He traveled a lifetime in one remarkable 18-month span. For most of us who are in the civil rights movement, but certainly those who are on the front lines during Mississippi summer, during that period I worked for the Congress of Racial Equality in the Northeast, a century of history was made. From the early voter registration work begun in the early 1960s, the murder of James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Mickey Schwerner, to the Freedom Ballot, to the Freedom Mississippi Democratic Party, to the Democratic Convention in August 64. In that one summer, the battle of Black sharecroppers, professionals, workers, students, and their white allies turned history and U.S. society on its head. As Cleveland Sellers, speaking for a generation, observed after the betrayal of the MFDP by the Liberal Democrats, quote, "Never again were we lulled into believing that our task was exposing injustices so that the good people of America could eliminate them. We left Atlantic City with the knowledge that the movement had turned into something else. After Atlantic City, our struggle was not for civil rights, but for liberation." And this is part of what we're calling the Revolutionary Black History Project of the show Voices from the Frontlines, because we think that an entire generation of Black, Latino, Asian, Pacific Islander, Indigenous, White, LGBTQ organizers really needs to understand Black history as a centerpiece for understanding their own sense of orientation today. So, starting with you, Claiborne Carson, I mean, your book, In Struggle, about SNCC, is one of the truly greatest books written about a movement. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, looking back at some of the debates that took place in SNCC at the time that you very effectively explained with respect for each position, why don't you tell some of our listeners what were some of the debates going on at the time that people were trying to figure out? And then as a historian, how do you look back at them today?
Well, I think that you've, Eric, placed it in the broadest context, and I'll try to even broaden it further. But this was a freedom movement. I think it diminishes it to call it a civil rights movement, because it makes it seem as if the goal was to get civil rights legislation. And as you know, the summer of 64 was the time of the passage of the first Civil Rights Act, and then the following summer, the Voting Rights Act. But for people who were immersed in the struggle, and I think the three of us would qualify in that regard, these were victories that were important, but they weren't the goal of the struggle. The struggle was freedom in its broadest sense of the word, and that what was happening in the South was also happening in Africa and Asia. The way I would put it is the peasants of the world were becoming citizens of the place they happened to live. And that's an important gain, but that was a step in terms of getting toward opportunities and freedom in the broader sense of the word, and that's not just the vote, but actually participating in decisions that affect one's life. So part of what was going on in the summer was an argument within SNCC, which I think is part of a broader argument about, well, what are we struggling for? Are we struggling for just the right to vote? Are we struggling for the right to make basic decisions about the collective destiny of this country? And I think by that time, liberal Democrats were willing to say, oh, yes, you should have a vote. There should be a Voting Rights Act. But very few of them were willing to say to sharecroppers in Mississippi, we really want you to help decide the future of this country.
Well, adding that, Clay, and I'm going to go to you, Judy, is that I think one of the things that was very interesting, even at that early stage, was the beginning of an internationalist consciousness. So when Plisauer says liberation, that was putting the movement in the context of the Vietnamese liberation, Cuban liberation, Malcolm's influence, even by 64. I think in your book, the trip to Africa came after that, the beginnings of their trips to Africa, but they were also being influenced. How much do you think in the summer of 64, the perception was, I'm asking you first, Clay, and then you, Judy, how much did you think the perception that the struggle was part of an international struggle in some way was part of people's consciousness at that moment?
I think that to answer that, you'd have to put that in a broader context, too. There always has been an internationalist perspective within the black community. You can't talk about people like Du Bois and Paul Robeson and so many others without understanding that they saw things from an international perspective. What happened was that because of the Cold War and anti-communism, a lot of us young people were cut off from that history. You know, I grew up and I thought of myself as fairly well college educated, but I knew very little about Paul Robeson. And that was purposeful, you know, that we were denied access to the insights that came from that previous generation that had always looked abroad because they were inspired by the African liberation struggles that were going on even as early as the 40s. They were involved in the Pan-African movement, but many of them came from the left, and of course Du Bois and Robeson were persecuted and silenced. So for us as young people coming up in the 1960s, we had to rediscover the international perspective that was already there but had been denied us.
Absolutely. And Judy, you know, you have a very interesting history. I was just looking at some of it. Of course, grew up in Tarrytown. I see your dad was with the United Auto Workers, which I was.
One of the organizers of the local. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pretty good, right? Coming out of a working class black family is very exciting. Then you go to Swarthmore and you work with Gloria Richardson, who you want to tell us about, one of the great true hero heroines of history. You end up in SNCC. Where were you exactly in the summer of 64? Walk us through where you were.
Okay, and let me, before I do that, could I just hook on to something that that Clay said?
Of course, Judy.
Okay, when I come in 1963, and as you said, I come off Swarthmore College's campus, there was an SDS chapter, and that's how I come in to the movement, and then come into the national office in Atlanta and of SNCC, and then we moved the whole national office of SNCC to Greenwood, Mississippi, that summer of 1964. But in terms of the international, when I come in 63, and again, to remember, we are at this point, most of us, 18, 19, 20 years old, because it's hard to, you know, you look at us now, and yeah, we look pretty good, but we were the age of many of the young people whom we're talking to a lot of times. So we're that age. But when I come in, one man, one vote was the slogan that I saw as part of SNCC. It was the bumper sticker that would be on people's briefcases. It would be on, not on car bumpers, because you would be even more easily arrested. But we had that all over. It was one man, one vote. Well, that came from the African liberation struggle. We were, for a number of young people, certainly, like Julian Bond, his father, was the former president of Lincoln University, right? Black college. Now, Julian remembers seeing Nkrumah. You know, there were people on these black campuses who come in as leaders in the student movement of SNCC, who have an up close and personal relationship with young Africans who then go into not only the liberation struggle, but then become leaders of their countries until many times, you know, like Lumumba, they are offed by the U.S. government and Belgium and whoever. But there was a very, it was a very personal relationship. So that, and I remember, and I have it in my piece, there's a book called Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by Women in SNCC. And it's 52 women. And one of the wonderful things is that you see a through line of all of the influences that these women have as their background. Many of them are family, you know, influences. But I talk about how, you know, when I come in, it's not only that I've just seen Mimi Feingold come back from the Freedom Rides and several weeks in Parchman Prison in Mississippi as head of the SDS chapter at Swarthmore, but it's also that I come in contact with somebody like Betty Garment, who comes out of UC Berkeley, is a little older than me, and starts talking about Nicaragua and Vietnam. And so I get immersed in a way that I would never have had I stayed at Swarthmore, and certainly had I stayed in Tarrytown, New York. I get immersed in this international movement for liberation. So we're talking about that in SNCC as young people, 18, 19, 20 years old, even in 1962, 63. And it's not just the slogan, it's this whole sense that we are part of a worldwide struggle. So should I still go?
No, I'm going to keep you. I'm not going to get you to Mississippi yet, because I want to stay one more round on that.
Okay.
In working with young people today, I work a lot in Los Angeles with the Labor Community Strategy Center. We work with a group called the Bus Riders Union, which is mainly low-income black and Latino bus riders, security guards, hotel workers, the unemployed, kids on their way to prisons. And then we're working in five or six high schools against the, we're calling the pre-prisoning and the mass incarceration of black and Latino people. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm very struck by is the young people's lack of a sense of history. And what I was trying to figure out was that when I got involved in CORE in 1964, the first thing that was done to me is sort of reconstructing my master narrative, which was not as anti-imperialist as it should have been. And within 2 weeks, we were back in 1492. We were back in Africa. You know, I mean, everybody saw the struggle as part of this long continuum. Betty Garman's an old friend of mine, by the way, and, you know, I'm sure we'll all. But as you point out, and Clay points out, the general sense of history, how did we get it? How were we lucky enough to get that internationalist consciousness? And then I'll put you back in Mississippi.
Well, certainly for me, I really would not have gotten it had I not chosen, and the choice is again really important, had I not chosen to enter this struggle, which was the student movement of SNCC. If I had stayed at Swarthmore College's campus, good Quaker school that it was, I would never have understood any of that history. So it is coming into this movement. And even with that, we did not, most of us at least, did not know about the history of struggle that goes on in Mississippi that you talk about as part of, you know, Charles Payne's I've Got the Light of Freedom or any of that in terms of who was there when we get there. I didn't know any of that. All I knew was the strong local people who helped to school us, who helped to nurture us and educate us. Now, in terms of how you pass that on, part of it is that, you know, Americans generally don't do history. I mean, they don't do anybody's history, you know, except, you know, what helps them keep power. So even when I'm teaching at Brown, because I was a visiting professor there, and you know, you get young people who are presumably, you know, the creme de la creme and stuff, you know, and as an African-American coming out of Tarrytown, you're right, I came from under the hill. What I get from my mother, who had an eighth-grade education but read everything and looked at me depressed and, you know, read the New York Post when it was still a newspaper. You know, all of that I get from her, but I don't get the history of struggle. Where I start getting that really does come through SNCC and then what I read afterward. But I find that young people coming into Brown, into my class, it's not all, and they get mad. But I used to have that one in 1990 when I was going around with Eyes on the Prize, and we had finished the first 6 hours of the 14-hour series. You know, and you would get young people saying, wait a minute, I went to the best schools. How come nobody told me this? They get mad about it because they understand that if you tell the real history, you will see yourself in that history. The way we tell it is not only that it neuters it, it takes real people out of, people say change agents, I hate that word, that they don't become the actors. So particularly since my course at Brown focused on young people as activists, they said, you know, they had no idea that young people their age had done what we did as young people, south, north, wherever we were, and in many different kinds of struggles.
Well, hold that, Judy, and I'm going to go back to, we're still going to get you back to Mississippi, Judy, but I'm going to throw now a question back to you and Clay, starting with Clay. I think one of the myths, let me put it this way, my political interpretation of organizing has always been that the organizer is a very conscious agent. The organizer wakes up in the morning with an agenda. An agenda is considered a good thing. The organizer has a plan. That's a good thing. The organizer approaches people in the community with at least some ideas. On the other hand, the organizer is a great listener and is smart enough to know that there's a dialectic. The second illusion is that it's assumed the organizer is middle class and the person you're talking to is working class. But of course we knew that in Mississippi that was not the case. It was a explosive combination of ex-GIs going down south, like Sam Block, Amzie Moore, who had been there forever, Medgar Evers, who had been there forever, and the students who had more ties to the south than normal in terms of the black students. So what I'm getting to is there was a stereotype of either that the students were the smart ones or the community was the smart ones and the students were arrogant. But my reading of history from Charles Payne's to your book to my own reading is what was exciting was the explosive combination of a Robert Moses and Amzie Moore talking to each other and shaping each other's consciousness writ large over thousands of those conversations. That was one of the factors that made the movement so powerful. What do you think about that, Clay, in terms of...
I think that that's one of the things that I've thought about a lot since then, of how organizing is always something done at the local level. And you need someone who understands what's going on at the local level, and you need someone who is concerned about how to make specific, concrete changes that improve the lives of people at the local level. And yet, it always needs to be in the context of a broader perspective. And sometimes it's not the same people who have both. I mean, it's very difficult to have both. You have to really work at trying to not get caught up in looking at what's going on at either the global level or the local level, but try to merge them both because they interact so much. And I think one of the things we've learned is that imperialism was the first globalization movement. And we need to understand that a lot of times the problems that we face at a local level have global significance or global causes. And unless we understand those global causes, we're not going to get very far. Now, that takes a long time, and our education system, rather than teaching us to understand that, often obscures that for us. You know, I think you could teach a history class that is all the typical things that are taught in a world history course of what elites have done throughout history, or you can teach a history class that understands the interconnections of freedom struggles in different parts of the world at different times. I mean, I don't think you can understand the African-American struggle without understanding the Indian independence movement and the Ghanaian independence movement, as Judy pointed out, with someone like as influential as Nkrumah and Gandhi, and you know how much we borrow tactics, we borrow ideas, and they're borrowing from us. and you know, the interconnections between the South African struggle and the African American struggle that go back to the 50s. You know, Martin Luther King was in touch with people who were involved in the anti-pass movement and during the 1950s, and the movement to boycott South Africa started in the 1960s and was an outgrowth of the activism that we're talking about today, you know, in Mississippi and other places. So all of these interconnections are the things that education should be, that should be the focus of education. That should be how history is taught. But instead, we don't tend to get that kind of usable history, except obviously there are those historians who try to do that, like myself, but that's against the grain. You know, I think that, you know, one of the things that is so important, you know, on a worldwide basis, is we glamorize this greatest generation who fought against Nazism and fascism. But the greatest generation were the black soldiers, not just American black soldiers, but Senegalese black soldiers and Indian soldiers and so many others who defeated fascism and came home after the war to defeat racism and colonialism and all of these other systems of evil. That was my father's generation. That was the generation of so many people who were played crucial roles in the struggles of the 1960s. And I think that we need to gain an understanding of the importance of that generation and understand the way in which they connected these struggles together. You know, the Double V campaign during World War II, victory against fascism abroad, victory against racism at home. That was something that motivated a whole generation of African Americans.
The voice you're listening to is Claiborne Carson. He's the head of the King Papers at Stanford University. He's invested as much of his life in the constantly evolving understanding of the tremendous contribution of Dr. King that we're going to come back to. And the of his many books, In Struggle, is it called The Black Awakening of the 1960s?
Yeah.
Just a very, very pivotal book about understanding what it really means to build an organization.
Judy and I got to know each other making Eyes on the Prize, which taught more people history than all of our books put together, but which is a very important educational thing. Although, looking back at that, I wish that Eyes on the Prize had done more to make these kinds of connections that I'm talking about.
Well, Judy, walk us through, you actually, the first day you show up in Mississippi, give us a sense of, you show up as in the Atlanta office, tell us just what it was like, how you got assigned, who you met the first day, how you got into the field. We've been kind of general a lot of ways. Bring it down to the one person, one experience for a while.
Well, because I was on staff and had been, I come in as part of the national office moving from Atlanta to Greenwood, Mississippi. And so when I get in, we know that those three particular civil rights workers, Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, are missing, and of course all of us understand that they are probably dead, because we had a very sophisticated two-way radio system, and everybody was supposed to call in every 2 hours, and they hadn't, so we knew that, you know, that they were probably gone. When I come in, you know, it's hard to, I can give you a general sense, but it's like a rush. You know, you come in and you're setting up the office, you're in Greenwood, Mississippi. Atlanta, you know, Greenwood is not even Atlanta. You know, I've been arrested in Atlanta, but this is something different. This is, you know, this is LaFleur County. It's Mississippi. And so I come in, and I am one of the people who mans or womans the 800 line. We called it the Watts line, the wide area telephone service. And so that would be like an 800 number that would allow everybody in what we call the field, all of the staff, who are operating all over the state of Mississippi, to call in again every 2 hours, or if a church were burned, or if one of the community centers was shot into, or the home of somebody who tried to register to vote was shot into, then we would get those calls constantly. So we're doing that, and then at the same time, you're trying to figure out how to survive in some ways. You know, I mean, I had always known that this was a bad state. I knew all that stuff. But It's like, you know, you're walking back to the place where you staying. I was walking with Dottie Zellner back to the place where we were staying, and, you know, somebody shoots at us. And so we, you know, head into a kind of gully. But see, that was not unusual for most of the people who had always worked there. This was a little, you know, for me, I go into denial. So Dottie says to me, "Judy, they're shooting at us." And I say, "Oh, no, no." You know, but we get down and I get back up. Same thing happened when two young guys, the McGee brothers, young guys from a strong movement family in Greenwood. Mrs. McGee was somebody who, when one of her sons, again, summer 64, one of her sons goes to try to sit in a non, you know, segregated way in the movie house because the civil rights bill has just been passed that June, right? So he goes in to sit down, and I should mention that the Mississippi movement had said there would be no demonstrations. We were actually only going to be doing voter registration. We did not want to be diverted by sit-ins or any public accommodation stuff. It was really supposed to be mainly building the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, challenging the all-white Democratic delegation from Mississippi, doing that road work, the hard work on the ground to build the party, okay? But young people are young people, and so they were even younger than I was, right? So, but one of the times when, I think it was Jake McGee, but one of the McGee brothers goes in and sits, you know, in the regular section, which is the white section. And when he goes home, some night riders come by Mrs. McGee's home, and she calls the sheriff and says, look, there are night riders outside, and if you want them to still be alive, you need to come get them, because otherwise their bodies will be strewn outside my house. Mrs. McGee did not play. There are famous stories about her where she, you know, kicks a police officer. I mean, she, in terms of most black people, local people, was never philosophically nonviolent. You know, she was always about self-defense, as were most of the people who helped protect us. So at this one particular time, the McGee brothers had tried to integrate this movie house in Greenwood. And then, and I'm in the office, and June Johnson, from another strong movement family, who was also a SNCC staff worker in Greenwood, and she came and got me, and she said, "We've got to go to the hospital, the segregated white hospital, because the McGee brothers had been taken there after they had come out of trying to integrate the movie house. They get in a car, and some white guys throw something through the window, and some the car window, and one of the McGee brothers got glass in his eye. So he's now been taken to this segregated hospital." So June, Greenwood activist, SNCC activist, comes and gets me because she knows I have the keys to one of the SNCC cars. And we drive, you know, and at some point we notice that there is this, you know, husband, I guess, couple, a white couple, looking really mean, and they pull up beside us as we're driving. And June says, "Hurry up, we got to get away from them." And I said, "Oh, no, no, you know, because in my mind, you don't drive over 25 miles an hour, because you will be arrested." Now, and then we hear this, what I thought was a backfire. June says, "They're shooting at us, hurry up." And I said, "Oh, no, no, June, that's just a backfire. And I'm just steady going 25 miles an hour." Now, I'm from Tarrytown. She's from Greenwood. You would think I would believe the woman, right? But in cases like that, sometimes I would be in denial, okay? And we got to the hospital. There's a white mob. And we get in, and there are six FBI agents. And they're roaming around the waiting room, which has a picture window facing into the waiting room. And I immediately start using my little dime, because nobody had cell phones, right? So I'm using my dime to try and call John Doerr at the Justice Department. I'm also trying to get to Foreman, Jim Foreman, the executive secretary, who, by the way, had recently come back from an anti-apartheid meeting in London. So there are all these connections. Anyway, so I'm
the
trying to get
him. The voice you're listening to, by the way, is Judy Richardson, Speak On, Sister.
Okay. So I'm trying to get him, Foreman, with my little dime and the coin phone, and then I'm trying to get John Doerr, and in the middle of that, some of these white guys, you know, throw something through the window. So we all rush around the corner behind a kind of a wall. And I had never seen FBI agents move so quickly. You know, they didn't move. They never did anything. And so they move around, and although I have spoken to them on the phone when, you know, somebody would call about a church burning or somebody who had gotten beaten for trying to register to vote, I knew that they were the enemy. I knew this. I knew they would do nothing. I knew that most of them were, you know, former Southern sheriffs who had been upgraded to FBI agents. I mean, up until the summer of 64, there was no FBI agent office in Mississippi. If something happened in the northern part of the state, it went to Memphis. If it happened in the southern part of the state, it went to the New Orleans office. So now, with all these white volunteers coming in, we have an agent in Jackson, okay? So I knew that, but there were six of them, and I turned around this corner following them, and they are seated on the ground as if, you know, that kind of see no evil, hear no evil, the three monkeys.
Right.
That's what they look like. And I start screaming at them, even though I know that they will do nothing. Even though I have screamed at them on the phone to try and get them to do anything, somehow seeing them in this way just sets me off. And, of course, they just ignore me. You know, they act like I'm just a crazy lady, you know, going screaming and yelling at them. And then I go back, and eventually, because of Foreman and I think because of John Doerr, first of all, we find out that the McGee brothers are okay, that his mother is there, and we know with his mother there, he is definitely okay, and because she will hurt somebody. And also because his older brother is a paratrooper and is, I think, was on leave, but he was a paratrooper. So he was in town as well and is at the hospital. So we find out that the McGee brothers are going to be okay, that the glass has been taken out of their eye, out of the one, I think whichever one it was, his eye. And then I am told that it's okay, we can leave now. And I say, well, who's going to, you know, get us home? And one of them says, well, it's going to be Sheriff so-and-so. And I said, so what guarantee do we have that we are going to get there safely, given that it is the sheriff who's taking us back to the SNCC office?
And that's what happened to Goodman and Cheney and Schwerner.
Yes, exactly. Except, well, something different for that, because, you know, first of all, I was not in the same danger, absolutely, because John Doerr knew where I was. They had contacted the sheriff to come get us. That was very different from the sheriff deciding, we're going to arrest these people and then give them to the dogs. But can I just say something parenthetically, which is we always understood that it wasn't about the sheriff. It wasn't about the Klan. It was about the absolute, total, state-supported and enforced terrorism. We knew that from top to bottom, from the governor to the state senators to the U.S. senators to everybody who was important, the boards of trade, the chambers of commerce, it wasn't these little Klan people who were the problem. It was the folks who had the money, who were the former, you know, planters, you know, in slavery. You know what I mean? It's the same guy, folks. And so it wasn't just you're worried about these little low-level Klan people. You're worried about the White Citizens Council, which is Chamber of Commerce and the bank owners and the, you know, they're the ones who are sponsoring, you know, the state-sponsored terrorism. So all of this is operating, we're operating in the midst of something that is absolutely top-down and is put in place to make sure that black people do not get registered. And that's one of our problems. How do you get black people registered to vote without getting them killed? And what white folks know is we're about to try and take away the whole thing about white supremacy. They know that the vote is one of those pillars that we're trying to build to get them out from under.
Well, Judy, let's hold that for a minute, because, I mean, that's quite a bit, and it's a great start. No. It's quite a bit of good stuff. I want to just find a frame now, which is, I think one of the things in the story, and you're listening to Judy Richardson, who is an author, who's a filmmaker, who's teaching at Brown. I want to make sure that I get my hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Accounts by Women in SNCC, and maybe have some of you authors back on a subsequent show. But I'd like to work a theme for a minute, which is, I think one of the things that was very complicated at this point in history is you have a Democratic president who is trying to find some mediation between the Southern racists and a civil rights movement But the Southern racists are in the Democratic Party. So contrary to what some people think today, I mean, the Dixiecrats were the Democrats, and most of them could care less what John Kennedy or John Doerr told them. So you had the problem of the federal government being ambivalent. As you said, the FBI being nothing more than local sheriffs who were deputized. You have a John Doerr who was in the Civil Rights Department and Justice Department, who was one of the best people, and yet in many of the studies, he gets mad when black people push him too far from the South, like, you know, as good as I'm doing for everybody. So there was quite a dialectical relationship between the Democratic Party, the National Administration, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and SNCC on the ground. And Clay Carson, how did that play out so rapidly between trying to get support for voting rights in Mississippi and then bringing it by the end of the summer to Atlantic City and asking the Democratic Party to decide which side is it on?
Well, I think that, that question, which side, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer's question, which side is the federal government going to be on, and more specifically, which side the Democratic Party is going to be on, well, that was the central question all the way from the 1930s, you know, when black people first started voting for the Democratic Party under Roosevelt. That was the dilemma of every Democratic president. They might personally want to have civil rights legislation, a Truman or a Kennedy or even a Roosevelt, but they knew that their party was controlled, particularly in Congress, by Southern segregationists who would never pass civil rights legislation. So Johnson's great decision, ultimately, and it was forced on him by the voting rights campaign in Alabama. He didn't want to face that decision, but he knew that if he supported strong voting rights legislation, that that would cost the Democratic Party the South. And in fact, what has happened is really his prediction. The 1964 election was the last election in which the majority of white Americans voted for a Democrat. It hasn't happened since, and it's not likely to happen anytime soon. You know, every subsequent election, the majority of white Americans have voted for Republican president. If there were no black people voting in America, we would have had 50 years of Republican president. The only thing that has really changed is because of the Voting Rights Act and because of the Immigration Act and all the things that were pushed through during the 60s, the electorate has changed so that now a Barack Obama can get elected with, you know, 40-some percent of the white vote and still win the election. And that's the great political change. But I think we need to, I think white Americans, especially who are progressive, need to understand that political reality. And part of that understanding is going into white communities and how do you change that dynamic so that 50-some percent of white Americans still vote for increasingly conservative, reactionary Republican candidates? And, of course, even the ones who don't are pulling the Democratic Party in that same direction. So we still face a dilemma that really has its roots in the summer of 1964, when at the Atlantic City Convention, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party put the choice to the Democrats at that time, and they weren't willing to take that risk at that time.
Well, one of the things, though, if we can bring it up to today, is that one of the dilemmas, and I think it is profoundly contradictory, is that there obviously has been a major change to allow the possibility of a black president. We can't underestimate that. On the other hand, the concept that there's 2.5 million people in prison, a million of whom are black, that the surveillance state, that the level of mass unemployment at a level that's just incomprehensible, that black people are driven out of the economy in droves permanently, as we're not even talking, I don't even think the term underclass is helpful anymore because it goes so deep into the economy. The fact that, in my opinion, the system has now felt that black labor is even not desirable and wants Latino immigrant labor, and is in a contradiction between black and Latino immigrant labor run by the system. The lack of new black leadership, I mean, when Al Sharpton has to become, you know, the spokesperson in some of these national campaigns, we're in a lot of trouble. And I think one of the things that we're trying to figure out in Los Angeles is not so much how are we even going to have the mass revolution, but how are we going to even reconstruct this voice? This voice seems to be the voice that we had, the voice that you just were saying now, Judy, about how you talk and how we talked and thought, has been so heavily suppressed out of the mass discourse, you know, that the best that President Barack could say, well, if I was Trayvon Martin, you know, I would sort of look like him. But we don't get to the heart of it. They did not indict Zimmerman. They did not indict the police force. The Obama administration has not helped us in Los Angeles in our civil rights fights, but in fact has sided with the MTA. So how do we begin to find in both of the work you're doing, maybe that's the way to start, is Judy, I'm trying to work through this Black Revolutionary History Project, this radio show, is trying to focus on reconstructing this history because of how relevant it is, starting with the issue, if I can say, about the mass discourse. You know, the way that black people and all of us talked back then, the audacity, you know, the what's now called a crime called willful defiance, that's been taken out of the public discourse. And for those of you who have been doing the studies, you know, and doing the work, where do you see as the hope right now, starting with you, Judy? Where do you think are the present reflections of the work that you did in Mississippi 50 years ago?
Well, I think part of it is that we did so many levels. We were working on so many levels. So, for example, there is now a SNCC Legacy Committee and on the board with Bernice Reagan and Bob Moses and Maisha, who is doing the Young People's Project. I mean, there are a lot of folks who are trying to continue some of that, and we're working with Duke University. But I would also say the other folks we're working with is Teaching for Change. And what you find through Teaching for Change, a national network of progressive teachers, which works with the Zen Ed Project, that there are, you know, we did freedom schools. But a lot of the people who left Mississippi continued in lots of different kinds of ways. Like, you know, Clay went in and started teaching the civil rights movement and how it relates to present-day conditions. So it wasn't only that people continued organizing like, say, Betty Garman does, or relating it to other kinds of struggles, but it is also... I'm going to mention one thing because I love this quote from Howard Zinn, who was a primary, you know, advisor to SNCC. And Howard said, you know, we are citizens and Obama is a politician. He says, but, you know, he's other things too. He's sensitive, he's intelligent, he's thoughtful, but he's a politician. If you're a citizen, you have to know the difference between them and you, the difference between what they have to do and what you have to do. And there are things they don't have to do. If you make it clear to them, they don't have to do it. So part of, I think, what we did is that we gave Obama, and I'm one of them, gave Obama a pass, President Obama a pass for a while. Part of that having to do with the fact that, you know, so many of the horrible racists were after him. And it's like, okay, well, we can't be part of the pack, you know, nipping at his heels and trying to kill him. You know, we knew that McConnell had said, you know, the main thing that the Republicans had to do was to defeat Obama, not get jobs, not do environment. No, we got to defeat. That was McConnell and the Republican Party on the eve of the inauguration, right? So you get as a progressive, you get into this kind of trick bag, as we used to say, of what do you do? And I think part of what I hear when I go around to schools and stuff, and also some of the folks that I deal with, I work with, you know, is that... Say, for example, I was on a phone conversation with Betty Garman, the one I was mentioning, Betty Garman Robinson, who for 20, almost close to 30 years, has been doing grassroots organizing through a lot of different groups. And so we were talking 2 weeks ago on a conference call with anti-racist young people who were somewhere at Highlander, and there were about 10 or so folks from Highlander, but there were folks from all over the country who had called into this conference call. And so you get a sense that people are working, they're organizing, but we're not necessarily aware of it. You know, that was when we were doing what we were doing in the 60s, people really knew we were doing it. The media was down. It was a story. You know, Claude Sitton is coming down from the New York Times. You know, you got all of these folks. But I think that moment is not, it's a different moment now. You know, I look at the Dreamers, for example, and I just see in them, you know, some of that energy and the young people in the Dreamers who are pulling their parents in at great risk to the parents themselves in the same way that we did in Mississippi and Alabama and Southwest Georgia. You know, I mean, I just think there are just a lot of things going on that we don't always know.
Absolutely, and I'll come back to some of that. Clay, what are you thinking about the legacy?
I think part of it is that I even resist using a term like legacy in the sense that I use it, but I understand that it gives the impression that there was this struggle that happened, and now we're talking about the legacy of it. And to me, I think the better way of looking at it is that there was a freedom struggle, and it was incomplete. It's still going on. And so young people should never have this feeling of, oh, I missed the 60s, that right now the struggle is just as intense and in some ways more heroic because you don't have a sense of being part of a march on Washington with 200,000 people and, you know, all the feeling that you get with that. But you have to understand that the march on Washington happened after meetings that five people showed up to. And that's the reality of 99.9% of organizing, is that you call a meeting and three of your friends show up and five of your friends finally don't show up. And you get discouraged and you go on to the next meeting and you try to do the next struggle. And that's the common reality. And I think that that's what we need to see, that kind of struggling is going on at every university and every community, and you just have to open your eyes to it and be part of it so that rather than five people show up, six people show up. And I think that kind of sensibility, many of my students have that. They understand that at some basic level. And in some ways, they're so much smarter than we were in that, you know, as I said, we got caught off from the global dimension because of the Cold War in large measure. I think many young people today have traveled in different parts of the world, which I wasn't able to do until the 60s. They understand globalization in a way I didn't even know what the term meant, you know, back in the 1960s. I knew that something was going on that affected me, but now you can't avoid understanding that. The question is, what do you do about it? And no one has quite figured out how do you fight effectively to bring about change at the local level when the cause of the problem is global.
Well, if it's okay,
that's a very difficult thing to do.
Well, as an organizer, if it's okay, I'll tell you a couple of my thoughts since I'm doing the work as well. And, you know, I think some of the things we're doing are pretty encouraging, and I want to talk about my understanding of the legacy and the good, you know, meaning an active legacy, is that I think it's very important to reestablish the terms of the debate and to set out a very firm set of points. So, for instance, at the Strategy Center, we have something called the Fight for the Soul of Cities, which is new. And we're talking about free the U.S. 2.5 million. And obviously that's sort of a pun on, you know, we used to say free the San Quentin 6 and free the this one 21. And now we're saying free the U.S. 2.5 million because for the vast, vast majority, this is really political prisoners and a mass incarceration that has nothing to do with crime. And so if everybody was working on sentencing reform or getting more money for even the public defender, or people were talking about better conditions in the prisons or the drug war, but if everybody ended by saying free the U.S. 2.5 million, we want all these people out of prison, we could begin to do, as you were saying, the one man, one vote, or no Viet Cong ever called me the N-word, or, you know, U.S. out of Vietnam, bring the troops home. We have a campaign called No Cars in L.A., which saying is that the urgency of the ecological crisis internationally requires the end of the automobile as we know it, and I come out of an automobile factory as an organizer. We're talking about open borders and amnesty, and I think, for instance, The idea of calling Obama the deporter-in-chief was a very big breakthrough by one of the Latino organizations. This not one person more, I think, is very important to say we can't have comprehensive immigration reform and militarize the border. We need open borders. So I think as we bring ideas out that are the kind of ideas, you know, like back then it was, should black people have their own state, was being discussed, right? I mean, should black people secede from the United States? There were 10-point programs, you know, as Fannie Lou Hamer said, we came to Mississippi with an independent program. We asked the Democratic what to do. I think the failure of the civil rights movement to put Trayvon Martin in President Obama's lap and demand that he do something is a real historical setback. And yet I think when we go to Mississippi in a week, I think we're going to see that a lot of the young people, as you were saying, from the Dreamers to the Dream Defenders, are moving in this more militant, but more intellectually militant way, where they're raising issues as a moral challenge to the system. And I think that's the greatest thing about Mississippi Summer, is not just telling it like it is, but doing it like it was. What do you both think of that?
I think the work that you're doing and the work that so many other people are doing is exactly my point, is that the struggle is going on. You know, I've argued with other historians and other activists saying that we need to move beyond this terminology about civil rights movement. Right. You know, that, yes, there was a civil rights movement, but it was part of something larger, and we have to recapture what that something larger was. No one that I know of who was active in the movement after the Voting Rights Act was passed said, oh, I can retire now from activism. the struggle is won. Martin Luther King didn't do that. Judy didn't do that. I didn't do that. You didn't do that. We all understood that an important victory had been won, and you have to recognize that and appreciate it, but it was simply another tool to get to the next stage.
Exactly.
And I think that now we are at that stage where, you know, some of the same issues are still with us. You know, if those 2.5 million who are in prison get out and vote, that might decide some elections.
That was a great end, Clay Carson. Judy Richardson, your punchline, from Mississippi to the present, where's your mind now?
I think remembering, and it's something I'm going to pick up on something Clay said, you know, we make it seem in Eyes on the Prize and much of the way we talk about the movement as if we go in, we have a, quote, mass meeting, unquote, and we have suddenly, you know, 7,000 people. No. In fact, it took days and days, and Clay is right. Sometimes the mass meeting would be you, your co-organizer, and her mother. And so what happens is that young people would come to us and say, what are we doing wrong regarding any protest they're currently involved in? Because they think that the movement happened quickly, you know, and it didn't. The sit-ins happened really quickly and amazing, but that was an aberration. And so for me, I keep thinking about some of the older activists who you realized were fighting for things that they might never see in their lifetime. But what they understood and had always understood was that if you do nothing, nothing changes. And so they kept going, even though it might not even come in their children's lifetime. But that, again, if you just sit back and say, well, that's just the way it is, that's just the way it's going to be then.
Well, Judy, if it's okay, I was training a young organizer 20 years ago named Kikanza Ramsey, and she was working out in Wilmington, and she got 20 people who said they were going to come to the meeting. And when she got to the meeting, one showed up. And she called me up in, you know, almost tears. She said, Eric, in the 60s, you know, you'd have hundreds and hundreds of people at the meeting, and what have I done wrong? I said, Kikanza, we had three.
Thank you.
We had three when you had one. Yes, it was better times, but let's put this all in perspective. You're doing great. You're doing great. And I think for those of us who have that sense to understand, which both of you do, of course, that part of the beauty was our willingness to build this movement one person at a time, is I think what a lot of people may not understand we did. And maybe that's one of the most important legacies, right?
Yes. That's a very good point.
A pleasure to have both of you on the show. You know you'll be back again. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. The voices you were hearing were Claiborne Carson and Judy Richardson. I think you also know that if we shut off the microphone and we all went to the bar, the three of us would be talking for at least another 2 hours. So we just started this conversation. I hope to see both of you in Mississippi, and keep talking and keep learning.
Great.
Take good care of yourselves.
Okay, you too.
So this is Voices from the Front Lines. This is your host, Eric Mann. This is being broadcast in Los Angeles, transparency, but fortunately, you're hearing it Tuesday night of the opening of Mississippi Summer 50th Commemoration. You are listening to the voices of Claiborne Carson, a tremendous historian and King scholar, and Judy Richardson, who's been a SNCC activist, an author. She worked on Eyes on the Prize. She's teaching at Brown University. And I think you can tell these are voices from the front lines. Take good care of yourselves, and all power to the people.